You might recall that the city of Toledo approved something called the Lake Erie Bill of Rights earlier this year. It basically gave nature basic rights, like human rights. This was the first time in the U.S. that a municipality approved of rights of nature for a distinct ecosystem. But this concept is part of an international movement. Ecuador was the first country to recognize the rights of nature in its constitution. Joining us to talk about this is Ode Salim. He's the Director of Environmental Law and Sustainability Clinic at the University of Michigan. Welcome back.
Thank you, Lester.
So we know about human rights and civil rights, although we're certainly still working on those. Now we're talking about rights of nature. What kind of rights?
So the rights of nature, you can think about it in terms of laws that you already know a little bit about. So for example, a lot of people know about corporate law, and they know that corporations are persons in a certain sense. Corporations can be the parties to a lawsuit. Corporations can be one of the parties to a contract. And then there's another area of law called guardianship. When you have someone who is a minor and too young to make their own decisions, or someone who may be incapacitated, that person can be a party to a contract or can sue or be sued in court. But again, it's not that person that's doing the talking. A guardian is doing the talking for them. So when we talk about natural rights or rights of nature, we're talking about a kind of combination of corporate persons and guardians. Essentially, you have a natural body like a lake or a river or a mountain, and you want that natural body to fend for itself, legally speaking. And of course, that natural body, at least most of us would agree that that natural body can't speak. At least it can't speak the languages that you or I speak. And so it needs somebody to speak on its behalf. In that sense, it's a little bit like guardianship. And it's not really a person. And so it's a little bit like a corporation.
So who gets to decide who gets to speak for that entity?
Well, think about corporations and incapacitated persons who need a guardian. The people who get to speak for them are people who have some close relationship to them, who are seen as being able to protect them and speak for them and have them enter into agreements or be parts of lawsuits.
Let's talk about Lake Erie as our example, because it was a small group in Toledo that got the city of Toledo to vote on it. They approved it. But Toledo's one city, and you've got other states and Ontario who also border Lake Erie. So how do you do that in that situation when the state says, hey, look, constitutionally, we own the rights to that and we're not going to give it up because it's been our job. That's what the Constitution says we should do. And one town comes along and says, no, we're going to take that away from you. And it didn't happen because the state basically blocked it. But what do you do in a situation like that?
So about 4 decades ago or 5 decades ago, in the 1970s, the Sierra Club brought a case, and they were trying to protect a particular mountain range, I think, or a valley. And the idea was that the Sierra Club did not have standing. So the Supreme Court decided that there was not enough interest among the members for the Sierra Club to be in court. But one of the Supreme Court justices, Justice Douglas, issued a dissenting opinion. And here's what he said, and this gets at the question that you asked. The justice said, the critical question of standing would be simplified and also put neatly in focus if we fashioned a federal rule that allowed environmental issues to be litigated before federal agencies or federal courts in the name of the inanimate object about to be despoiled, defaced, or invaded by roads and bulldozers, and where the injury is the subject of public outrage. So what Justice Douglas was talking about in the early 70s was that this should really be federal law, that if we as a society are outraged by injury to the environment itself should be able to sue in its own name and protect itself. That federal law recognition that Justice Douglas envisioned in the early 1970s never came to fruition. We never got that federal law. We haven't even really gotten state laws. So one of the issues, as you say, in Lake Erie is that it's tough for a local government to do something like this because local governments are creatures of state government, and because states are creatures of federal government, we often ask ourselves, when a local government passes a law, is there anything at the state or federal level that could be obstructed or impeded by that local law? That's what many of the opponents of the Lake Erie Bill of Rights are saying.
One of the things in researching this interview I ran into was, yes, we have these laws, but these laws basically are putting limits on pollution. They allow pollution. The whole function is you're going to pollute, but we're going to reduce that pollution to this level, and that's the acceptable level. And when I thought about that, I'd never really viewed it from that perspective. And given the current political climate in Washington, we're actually reducing protections for the environment. What are the legal arguments you'd make to persuade a judge that rights of nature laws should be allowed?
Well, in many places where rights of nature has taken hold, one of the ways that judges have been convinced is the judges have responded to the lack of action by government to either create the appropriate regulations or to enforce the ones that are on the books. This is what happened essentially in Colombia and in India. In Colombia, it was the river Atrato, and in India, it was the river Ganges. And you had courts in both of those countries saying, essentially, we are sick and tired of seeing these cases come before us over and over and over again about pollution. Apparently, the laws that we have on the books aren't working the way that they're supposed to be working. So we, the judges, have to step in and recognize that there is a legal right for the resource itself to be protected for its own sake. And it might be the case that one approach in the United States would be to say, you know, we've got the Clean Water Act and we've got lots of other statutes, and, you know, they work just fine with regard to certain resources and under certain circumstances.
Right, point sources with pipes and things like that.
But yeah, you bring up a good point there with point sources. When you have a pipe, it's a lot easier to regulate the pollution that comes out of the pipe. It's a lot more challenging to regulate diffuse pollution, pollution that comes from lots of different sources where it's harder to trace the source of the pollution. So one approach that some of these nature's rights advocates are taking is to say, yes, we've got the Clean Water Act and we've got the waste management statutes and the Clean Air Act, but they don't protect all resources in the same way. Some resources are left underprotected by certain kinds of pollution. That's where a legal framework like the rights of nature could perhaps step in and fill a gap.
What kind of momentum is there among environmental groups and activists to push the rights of nature issue through the political process?
So as someone who is not only myself a lawyer who practices environmental law, but also an observer of other people who do it, I would have to say that I don't know that the momentum right now is widespread or particularly strong. There's no question that ever since that Justice Douglas opinion in the early 70s, that concept has taken hold more and more, at least in North America. And I imagine that so long as we see either poor environmental laws or poor enforcement of the environmental laws that we have, so long as we see those trends continuing, and of course we see in different countries, including our own, scaling back on some of the environmental regulations, I think so long as we see those kinds of things happening, especially at a national level, what you're going to see is localized outrage. And one of the ways that people are going to try to deal with this is to say, if you national folks can't get a grip, we at the local level are going to do what we need to do to create ordinances at the city level, the county level, maybe even laws at the state level. So long as you have environmental laws that aren't working, I think this movement may in fact grow and gain momentum.
Odeh Salim is Clinical Assistant Professor of Law and the Director of the Environmental Law and Sustainability Clinic at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in and explaining this to us.
You're very welcome.